Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guest will argue that energy independence is a popular charade masquerading as energy strategy. He is Paul Roberts, the author of the book The End of Oil. His latest article, The Seven Myths of Energy Independence, appears in the May-June 2008 issue of Mother Jones magazine. Paul Roberts, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
It's good to be here with you this morning.
You start off this article in myth number one by talking about President Bush's State of the Union address, in which he declared the United States to be addicted to oil, often imported from unstable parts of the world. And, of course, he announced plans to break this addiction by developing alternatives, including a multibillion-dollar subsidized ramp-up of biofuels, and had boldly stated that by 2025, America could cut imports from Gulf states by three-quarters and make our dependence on Middle Eastern oil a thing of the past. Myth number one, energy independence is a good thing. What do you think?
Well, I mean, just in your what you quoted of his, or paraphrased of his speech, really, I think, reveals a lot of the problems of energy independence. I mean, there are, without a doubt, serious problems with depending so heavily on imports of anything or just needing so much of any particular commodity such as oil. But think of what he's saying. He's saying that by a certain date, we're going to rid ourselves of Middle Eastern oil, or a large fraction thereof, as if there is some difference between Middle Eastern oil and oil from Russia or oil from Mexico. This is, I guess, part of the first myth, is that there is some difference between oil that we get from, say, Texas and some oil that we get from Iran, or rather from Iraq. This comes up, this idea of weaning ourselves of foreign oil comes up every few years. It's been sort of cycling through the political system since the 1970s, when Richard Nixon first proposed that America free itself of the chains of foreign oil, and there's a number of problems with it. But primarily, what people need to understand, first of all, is that it's oil that we need to really change the way we use, not necessarily foreign oil. But the problem with that, the problem with changing the way we use oil, is that it's a long, very complicated and expensive process, and during that process, which will take decades, we're going to need a lot of that same oil, which means that we will be depending on foreign oil for some time, even in a best-case scenario, and that is a sort of a level of complexity that is hard to get across in a bumper sticker, and it's certainly not something you're going to put in a State of the Union speech.
One of the questions that your article brings up is the debate over energy independence is a distraction from the more crucial question of how to build a secure and sustainable energy system. What do you see as the possible outcome of this quest for secure and sustainable?
Well, the objective of any country, and particularly one like America, which uses so much energy, should be an objective of energy security. That is, we need to establish secure access to supplies of energy that are, again, they're secure, they're reliable, they're affordable, they're environmentally and politically sustainable. It doesn't make any sense to lock ourselves into a new energy supply, such as coal, if we haven't determined a way to use that fuel without causing all sorts of additional environmental problems. So you have to redefine what you mean by energy security, and then ask yourself what sources of energy would best meet that objective. And the problem with oil, clearly, is that it's not politically stable, it's not environmentally safe, and so it fails on a couple of critical criteria there. So any time you're asking about a potential alternative to oil, whether it be biofuels or wind or coal, nuclear, you have to, does it fit this criteria, this larger criteria of energy security? And what's interesting about energy security is that it might be that we're more secure importing a certain amount of our energy. But that, again, is a sort of a tough sell in a campaign season.
Mm-hmm. We are talking with Paul Roberts, the author of the book The End of Oil, and his latest article, The Seven Myths of Energy Independence, appears in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. Myth number two, ethanol will set us free. And what do you see as the difficulty in being freed by ethanol?
Well, I think first, you know, we have to sort of go back to the 2005, 2004 when the legislation was being debated that would provide a subsidy for refiners of ethanol. And at the time, you know, this was really pushed and as a sort of a win-win. I mean, this would be a way to increase our supply of a non-oil fuel. It would be a way to keep energy dollars at home rather than sending them abroad. And it would also be a way to help out the Farm Belt, which has been mired in a sort of economic depression for decades. And at the time, corn was selling for $1.85 a bushel, which was less than it cost farmers to actually produce it. And the only way they could produce it was through a pretty heavy federal subsidy. So it appeared as if ethanol might be a way to sort of, you know, make unnecessary these federal subsidies, improve our energy security, and you know, help out a great many in the Midwest. What's happened is that, you know, for all the best of intentions, demand for corn, particularly, went up so high that the price of corn now has tripled, and that's raised the price of everything that requires corn, whether we're talking corn flakes or, you know, whiskey or, you know, pig feed. And a country like America can, in fact, support or can tolerate food prices going up. The problem is with the many countries elsewhere for whom higher food prices can be disastrous. So what we've realized is that it's all connected. You can't just fiddle with one part of our energy economy without expecting some sort of effect elsewhere. In this case, you know, we thought, all right, we'll simply, you know, get our energy from another source. We didn't, you know, ask or didn't ask thoroughly enough, is that other source itself, in this case farm acres, is that other resource also limited?
Let's take some phone calls, and if you'd like to join the conversation with Paul Roberts, the number for you to call in Madison is 263-1890 or elsewhere, 800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. Talking about the seven myths of energy independence that Paul wrote that appears in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. Brett in Waukesha, let's bring you into the conversation. Go ahead.
Thanks, Jim. Interesting show. Glad to hear you in the morning. But, yeah, on this corn issue, I was wondering what kind of solutions does he have for a state like Wisconsin? We import $20 billion worth of energy every year. That's, you know, at least $12 billion going out of the state, 300,000 lost jobs. And, you know, the good news about our ethanol production, and we're working on switchgrass, you know, biofuels and other low-carbon fuels, is that, you know, they keep some of that money here, and we're producing about 450 million gallons of ethanol right now, which is about a sixth of our gasoline consumption. So what's your solution? I mean,
that's a really good point. You know, in areas in the Midwest, the ethanol sort of revolution has really made a lot of sense, because you've got consumers of ethanol, people who can make ready use of it sort of near where it's being produced. That's a bit of a problem when you're talking about consumers in places like California. So there's a transportation bottleneck that really wasn't, I think, as well thought through as it should have been when the ethanol industry, or when the expansion of the ethanol sector was being considered. But in terms of solutions, the number one solution, whatever we're talking about, whether we're talking about, you know, considering nuclear or biofuels or, you know, clean coal, the number one solution before you get to any of those has to be hardcore conservation, I mean hardcore efficiency. I know this is a tired drum that we keep beating, but, you know, we've shown time and time again that you will get, you know, that the best way to improve your energy security is by reducing your demand. As long as we continue to simply look for new supplies to switch from oil to, say, biofuels, or switch from oil to, you know, gasified coal, we're still putting ourselves in this at the same risk that at some point that supply is going to somehow be limited. It's either going to be limited politically or environmentally. On the other hand, if you simply focus your efforts on reducing demand, then you're reducing your risk. And you can't, you know, conservation efficiency isn't the one solution that's going to get us out of this mess, but it has to be where we start. And the problem with conservation is it's hard to make money at it. You can't sell conservation. Energy companies want to sell something, like any company.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't sell oil, they'll sell biofuels or they'll sell hydrogen. They don't really care what they sell as long as they can make a reasonable profit at it. We've got to find a way to sell efficiency, and really where that selling has to start is in the political sphere. So the solution has to begin with a radical change in our approach to energy efficiency.
You also say that better energy efficiency is one of the fastest ways to reduce not only energy use but pollution and greenhouse gas emissions, both of which are becoming more to the forefront in American minds.
Right, and energy security has to. You can't have energy security at the expense of environmental security or a worsening climate. We've long recognized that energy is the nexus of a lot of these other issues. It's where climate really has to. It's where the rubber hits the road in climate. And if we're not addressing climate at the same time, then we will be having this conversation 10 years from now or 20 years from now. So whatever new fuels we come up with have to fit into a climate template. And because we're discovering that corn-based ethanol has fewer climate benefits than we'd thought before, that again sort of underlines the idea that the best way to deal with the climate issue is the same solution as dealing with the energy crisis, and that is use less. But again, that is a hard thing to sell in an economy that's set up for selling things.
Was there something dramatic that went on in Congress in the last 10 days or so regarding fuel standards?
Well, we've got, once again, we have a lot of momentum behind improving fuel standards. But we've been talking about this for the past couple of years. Well, we've been talking about it for decades. But, again, we're talking about it, but the standards that are being bandied about are really fairly modest. They will be deployed over a number of years, so their effects won't be felt for some time. And in the meantime, you've got countries like India and China whose demand for oil is rising so fast that given our modest proposed reductions, or rather, given how modestly we're going to improve our gas mileage, any oil we save will be sucked up just as quickly by countries like China. So we're really rearranging deck chairs as opposed to changing the course of the ship.
And, Brett, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate your remark. And William and Viola, let's give you a chance. Hi.
Hi. You're talking about saving energy. I don't have a single incandescent bulb in my house. I've got two H40 Southwest windmills out here. They're generating electricity pretty good the last few days with all the wind we've had.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got a small two-cylinder diesel engine that I run on used French fry grease for backup. And then I've got it down to about 600 gallons of LP I use for a year for hot water and heating. So my carbon footprint is pretty small. And my point is, if I'm going to wait for the federal government to do it, I'll be dead.
Uh-huh.
I'm 73 now. I'm not going to live that long. If you're going to do anything about changing this use of this energy, is you got to give the grants to the individuals, homeowners, that they can put solar panels and windmills up in their yard and do it now, not next year, not the year after, not 10 years down the road. We got to do it today.
First of all, I congratulations on that kind of work. What did that reduce your LP from? How much LP were you using?
I have no idea what I was using, because this is a brand-new house.
Right. Well, what's interesting here is that, in places like, say, Japan, the government decided to get behind solar energy and made grants to homeowners so they could put them on their roofs, put the systems on their roofs. And that's sort of what your caller is talking about, with really targeting that income toward individuals who can then use it for specific tasks, as opposed to filtering that money through an industrial sector. I mean, I think you need both. But this raises a really good point, which is that so much of our political capital and financial capital is getting sucked up by sectors that are politically powerful and that have a lot of sway in Congress, even if it might make more sense from the standpoint of long-term energy security to target more of that money toward individuals. I would add to that I would hope that you know, citizens, and I don't want to call us consumers anymore because I think we've got to be more than that if we're going to solve this problem. But I would hope that citizens would begin to take initiative on their own. I think this the caller program is really a great example. We might not all be able to put up windmills in our backyard, but beginning to seriously investigate your own energy patterns, your own energy use patterns, and what you might do to change those is the way that this has to start. Because as long as we can, as you point out, as long as we continue to just wait for the solution to be sort of dropped in our laps, A, it'll take too long, and B, the solution, when it finally arrives, probably won't be the one that we need.
William, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guest is Paul Roberts. He is the author of The End of Oil. His latest article, The Seven Myths of Energy Independence, appears in the May-June 2008 issue of Mother Jones Magazine. And we'll take more of your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Paul Roberts about his article on the seven myths of energy independence. Myth number one, energy independence is good. Myth number two, ethanol will set us free. Myth number three, conservation is a personal virtue. And myth number four, we can go it alone. What's wrong with the idea that that we can do this on our own, Paul?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, some of the stuff we've already discussed, we use a massive amount of energy, so much right now, that we can't possibly stop relying on imported energy. You know, 60% or nearly 60% of our oil comes from abroad, and we also import, you know, great volumes of other forms of energy, natural gas, and including even coal in some cases. So the whatever, even if we decided from this point on that we were going to transform our energy system, it would take so long that we would need to, we'd need to rely on those foreign sources for some time. I mean, consider the idea: if we had a fleet of new cars, new hyper efficient, let's say electric cars, and that we had at the same time developed a system to produce electric power that was environmentally safe. It would, and that these electric cars were available on every car lot in the country, and they were affordable, and we liked them, we wanted to buy them, so we're ready to go. It takes about 12 to 15 years to roll out, to replace a fleet, and that's the best case. And truly, we, you know, given that we don't have those technologies, given we don't have those kinds of cars on every car lot, we're you know, realistically, we're thinking 25, 30 years to roll out this new fleet. During that time, we will need to have fuel to power the old fleet. And although we could dramatically reduce how much fuel we're using in that old fleet, we still need a great gob of oil. And so some of that oil, and since we, you know, can't produce nearly all our oil needs at home, we'll be relying on foreign sources. So there's the whole notion of requiring foreign supplies during this transition. The second issue, and this is the one that really doesn't get enough attention, as we mentioned before, even if we adopted these fairly modest improvements in our fuel economy that are being talked about in Congress, that, you know, China and India's demand for oil is going up so fast that the world oil market wouldn't even notice. Every barrel that we didn't use, they would use in Beijing or New Delhi. So the broader question is, if we solve our own energy security problems but leave the rest of the world on this track that it's on right now, we haven't done anything, because the world's problems are our problems. I mean, clearly that's the case in climate, but it's also going to be the case in oil. If even if we stopped using any Middle Eastern oil, as if there were a distinction, but even if we stopped using, relying on the Middle East, because all our trading partners rely on the Middle East, anything that happens to them, anything that happens to the Middle East will hurt them and therefore us. So again, we can't do this alone. We have to make sure that the rest of the world comes along and improves its own energy security, which means that a lot of the solutions we come up with, we have to at least consider whether they will be applicable in the rest of the world. So, you know, are they going to be, can they be used in Europe? Well, probably. Can they be used in China? Well, maybe. Can they be used in some of the poorer countries that are going to be needing more energy in the next couple of decades? You know, if we've got plug-in hybrids, oh, that's great. And Europe could certainly, you know, make use of those as well. But what about China? Well, probably some of the wealthier citizens in the cities, yes, but certainly not the hundreds of millions of farmers. They couldn't afford them. And what about in Africa? Clearly no.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean that we shouldn't use plug-in hybrids here? Of course not. But it does mean that as we move forward and begin developing new energy technologies and more efficient technologies, we have to be mindful that at least some of these technologies need to be sort of exportable to the rest of the world so that the entire world can move forward toward better energy security.
Let's take some more calls. Matt in Milwaukee is next. Hello, Matt. What's on your mind this morning?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a question for the guest. How does he see, or does he see, just the very fabric of American society changing in the future as oil begins to become more scarce? I haven't, done any research, so I don't know any figures, but just my assumption is, at some point, when oil really starts running low, the mobile society everyone takes for granted in the U.S. is going to, not exist anymore, and unless there's planning for it, things like food transportation, mail, stuff like that's going to, things are just going to come grinding to a halt, and I'm just curious as to whether he's given that any thought or whether he has any research on that whole topic.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
That's a great, I just completed a book that's coming out in June on the food economy and asking sort of these questions. How do we sustain a population that'll be, around 10 billion by the middle of the century, but do it in a world that will have, fewer acres per person, less energy, less water, and an unstable climate? How do we feed everyone? And really, energy is one of the critical sort of Achilles heels of our food system, our entire economy, but food in particular. When you go back and look at what has cheap oil allowed us to do in terms of our food production, it's astonishing. I mean, cheap oil and natural gas go into making fertilizers and pesticides upon which most industrial farming is absolutely dependent. Food allows us to move those fertilizers from where they're produced to the farmers. It allows us to move the food the farmers produce to markets. And this is sort of understood, but when you look more closely, you realize that the fact that you and I can go to the supermarket in January and get lettuce, or get a nice mixed salad, or fresh fruit, you realize that that stuff has come, in many cases, from the other side of the planet. The only way it could come is with cheap energy. And if you were to suddenly jump forward to a time when energy was, triple or three times, triple or quadruple what it costs today, what pieces of our food system would survive? A lot of folks suggest that we'll have to move back to more local production. And that's great, except what about the countries that can't produce enough food locally? Maybe you and I could get used to having, no mixed salads in January. I mean, people managed to survive for a long time, but there are whole regions that are utterly now, have become completely dependent on imports. They grow one or two crops, and they export those, and they use the revenues to buy the things they no longer grow. So these are questions that people are just now beginning to ask in a serious way, at least in the mainstream. And the answers that keep coming back aren't that encouraging.
Matt, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison, 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. Paul Roberts is our guest. His article, The Seven Myths of Energy Independence, appears in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Daniel in Rice Lake, let's bring you into the conversation.
Hello. I believe the logical position is to burn petroleum from overseas sources and hoard domestic reserves for strategic reasons and also because in the future reserves will be much more valuable. How much of the Earth's oil reserves are estimated to be in the Arctic Basin, which will be open to exploitation after the Arctic ice melts seasonally?
Well, that's a good question. The estimates vary pretty widely. It really sort of depends. I think there's a lot of politics in these estimates. I think if you're opposed to exploring the Arctic for oil, then you downplay the amount of oil you think is there. And if you are trying to encourage that, you suggest that there's great gobs of oil. My sense from talking with people in the industry is that there is, you know, certainly untapped oil to be found in the Arctic. Probably not. There's not enough to seriously change the fact that we need to move away from oil. Now, your caller makes a really good point in that when times get tight, in the future, when people are starting to consider strategically, you know, when countries are basically fighting over what oil is left, the issue, you know, and you're in a sort of an emergency scenario, the issue is less what should we do, you know, what's the most sensible from an environmental or political standpoint, but really what do we need to do to keep our economy from going completely in the tank. And at that point, we and other big importers of energy will probably be inclined to take whatever we can find. And as the Arctic becomes more readily accessible because the ice recedes or disappears entirely, we will certainly be able to look for oil there. The question is, how much is there? And this brings us right back to the sort of the original question, which is, you know, should we be doing something now to move ourselves away from oil? Because if we don't, then we're sort of guaranteeing that we will be in that kind of an emergency scenario 20 or 30 years from now.
In looking at your myths, myth number five is that some geek in Silicon Valley will fix the problem. Can we understand that there's not enough research going on to be able to fix the problem?
Well, we have a great history of sort of innovating ourselves out of problems, and I have no doubt that there are a great number of ideas on drawing boards right now that we haven't heard of, and that many of those have huge potential. I mean, we always are surprised by what we can figure out, and you know, so that I think that's a given. But any of these ideas, no matter how good, requires support. It requires political and financial support to sort of bring it to a point where the market is ready to recognize it as economically viable. And unfortunately, because the way that our research system is set up, the money flows toward projects that are already sort of proven, that are already sort of sure things. And so that's why we see a great deal of energy research going toward biofuels, and particularly corn-based ethanol. I mean, we know that corn-based ethanol is probably not the best way to make energy, and we're learning that, you know, and we're becoming more and more sure of that every week. There is great hope for cellulosic ethanol, that is turning, you know, plant waste, crop waste, so they're non-essential, you know, organic waste into alcohol. But because that isn't where the money is, there's much more money to be made in corn-based ethanol. We're not getting enough research there. And so across the spectrum, when you look at technologies that might have a beneficial impact and a significant and meaningful impact on our energy economy, in many cases, those aren't getting the dollars that they need to be brought to fruition. And instead, we're sending our money toward sort of status quo technologies. And that's a vicious cycle. I mean, that just guarantees that those the technologies we need are going to fall farther and farther behind.
And to Jim in Pleasant Prairie next. Hello, Jim.
Yes, good morning. please notice how much the presidential candidates are talking about the issue of the E85 ethanol. I'd like to talk about that point, parts of that discussion that was passed over earlier in the program, I describe as the effects of socialism and farmers on welfare. The actual cost of the E85 ethanol, with the subsidies considered, is between $7 and $8 a gallon. So as an effect of that, look how it's affecting the American consumer, the American taxpayer, international consumers, the poorer ones that are facing a starvation diet right now, and it's all for the Farm Belt vote. Who's talking about repealing this big mistake that was made earlier? And ironically, there are leaders in poorer areas of the world that are blaming capitalism. Where I think if you examine the situation, it's really socialism is the root of the problem here.
Well, that's it. I mean, I guess I would probably, I wouldn't call it socialism. I'd call it, you know, government favor. It's basically government favoritism. You know, government's favoring certain sectors over at the expense of others. I agree totally, though, that we've sort of seen that the ethanol experiment, at least the corn-based ethanol experiment, hasn't given us the results that we'd hoped for, and in fact, it's gone the other way in many areas. You know, and if you look at the way the industry itself is suffering, I mean, if, I know that ethanol refiners may not be merit a lot of sympathy right now, but their own models were based on corn not getting over $3 or even $3.50 a bushel. They felt they could make money until that point, and since corn is much higher than that, they're not making a lot of money right now. And some of those refiners who hedged their corn purchases are still making money, but for the most part, it's pretty lean times because they themselves did not anticipate how high corn prices would go. Now, the question then is, since the business model has been shown to be faulty, and since some of the science surrounding ethanol has been shown to at least need more work, we're sort of at a decision point. Can we recognize the problem here and try to fix it by, say, reducing the subsidy on this, or as some in the industry are calling for? I mean, right now they want to increase the subsidy. Right now, the industry gets a 51-cent per gallon tax credit, and some are saying that they need a 75-cent per gallon tax credit in order to stay in business. Now, you have to realize that a 51-cent a gallon tax credit allows a refiner to buy corn, since it takes about 3 bushels of corn to make a gallon of ethanol. That gives that refiner around $1.50. Bidding advantage. He can pay $1.50 more for corn than can other non-subsidized buyers of corn. If we went to 75 cent a gallon subsidy, he would now have a $2.25 advantage, which would drive up the price of corn even higher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that has a political chance, but the fact that the industry, some in the industry, are considering that shows how, I think, unrealistic the perspective is within this industry in some parts. And it really calls out for, I think, some strong leadership here on, you know, recognizing that, you know, the question isn't E85. You know, the question is, it's E at all. You know, is this really something we really need to be pursuing?
Jim, thank you very much for your call, your question. We're talking with Paul Roberts, whose article, The Seven Myths of Energy Independence, appears in the May-June 2008 issue of Mother Jones magazine. We'll talk about those myths, take more of your calls in just a moment, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, in for Kathleen Dunn, has the day off today. And we are taking your calls as we talk with Paul Roberts, the author of a book called The End of Oil. One of the things that I was noticing about myth number six is that cut demand and the rest will follow. And you talk about most credible proposals toward energy security call for some kind of energy or carbon tax. And how will that work?
Well, I think that the carbon tax is sort of crucial here. Again, energy and climate are linked in complicated ways, and you can't or shouldn't have an energy policy that doesn't take into account the serious condition that the climate is in. So you want to reduce both energy consumption and carbon emissions, and so your energy solutions need to be low or no carbon. And again, efficiency is first and foremost, the single best way to accomplish both of those things. So I think that you need to, make carbon a good that costs people to use. And, clearly you could be taxing fuel, you could be taxing, coal. There are all sorts of ways that you can signal consumers in the market generally that they want to be using or producing less carbon. Now, that's all fine in theory, you know, there all there's some really great ideas about how you'd start this carbon tax low. You give people like a 10-year warning, and then say in 2018 we'll start at a certain amount per ton, and that rate will go up at the rate of inflation until it reaches the point where it's provoking the economy to get rid of carbon. Okay, again, that sounds great in theory. The problem is we don't really start worrying about energy problems until the price of energy is high. I mean, most of us don't. We don't even think about it, consumers, companies, countries. We ignore energy until it becomes painfully expensive. And all of a sudden, we're all about changing our ways and efficiency and all sorts of other great ideas. The problem is that's the last time that the public is interested in a tax of any kind. And so any politician that would be brave enough to get out there and say, my fellow Americans, I'm sorry you're suffering at the gas pump, but I need to, saddle you with still more costs in the form of a carbon tax. I mean, it won't happen. And in fact, the opposite is happening. What we have now is politicians, Senator McCain, the Republican, likely Republican candidate for president, has proposed rolling back the federal gas tax. He wants for the summer, he wants to give us a gas tax holiday. And if you think about it, quite aside from the fact that an 18 cent reduction in the price we're paying at the pump is fairly minuscule, any time you make, to the extent that it had an effect, it's going to encourage us to use more. I mean, any time anything gets cheaper, we tend to use more of it. So we'd probably end up using more and driving the price right up to where it had been before the tax was, that relief was enacted. But my point is that it's politically very difficult to even talk about raising taxes at a time like this, and yet this is precisely the time with people's attention focus that we need to begin having that conversation. So it sort of raises the point, rather, that we need to have a new way of discussing this. And the way we discuss it and have discussed it for the last 100 years is essentially to, push off the hard questions for the next campaign cycle, and that's really going to have to stop. We're going to have to address these now.
Are you among the people who felt that President Bush should have advocated for a fuel tax or some other demand reduction measure in the aftermath of 9/11, when oil prices were relatively low and Americans were probably in the mood for some kind of sacrifice?
I think that would have been, I mean, imagine if President Bush had said, post 9/11, by the way, folks, one of the things that we're going to have to do in this war on terror is to reduce the amount of oil we're using, because so much oil, our dependence on oil is just making us vulnerable to so many different fronts. We're relying on places like the Middle East, which are hugely unstable. We're sending our money to countries who are then taking some of that money and funding the very terrorists that we're going after. So he could have made a fairly cogent and I think convincing argument that this was the time we needed to wean ourselves, not just from foreign oil, but all oil, and we're going to do that in the form of a tax. Now, at the time, oil was, $35, $40 a barrel. Imagine if we had imposed a tax, and even if, and over the year, the years since, that tax had been accumulating in a fund that was then used to develop some of these new technologies for alternative energy technologies, ways to improve our efficiency. Imagine where we'd be right now. We might be paying the same for oil or gasoline at the pump in terms of consumers, but more of that premium, that extra price, would be going for beneficial uses. As it is, we're paying more at the pump, but every additional penny that we're paying or much of it is going overseas, again, to countries who do not share our interests.
To the phones again, to Bobby in Stevens Point. Hello, Bobby.
Hi, good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me on, and welcome to Wisconsin, Paul.
Thank you.
I had a couple questions and comments as to your view. I don't know if you covered the timing of the global peak of oil production, but I'm in the camp that Matt Simmons is in and other people arguing that the peaking of global oil production happened already in 2006, and we're now into the rounded part of the peak. But you don't see the politicians acknowledging that. I mean, they're going with the Saudi view and the Energy Information Agency saying that, oh, it's 20 years off. We don't have to worry about it. I think they do that because it's more comforting. It's easier to tell the voters, you know, we have plenty of time to work on this. And so that I would be interested in your view on the timing of the peak. Second thing that's happening, while everyone is focusing on the motor fuels for consumers, you know, the gasoline, they're ignoring what's happening with the heavy fuels like diesel and jet fuel and so forth. And there's already shortages cropping up around the world. You saw this with China over the winter. So, I mean, if that keeps going, we're going to see the airlines seizing up. We're going to see the trucking industry freeze up. We're going to see the container ship industry and then agriculture. I mean, so I'm wondering what your view on that timing of the peak is.
Okay.
Well, let's look at the second question first, this notion of sort of heavy oils like diesel and jet fuel. And I think that the and heating oil, I think that the market's going to sort that out in the sense that as the prices for heating oil and diesel, which are essentially the same thing, as those prices continue to rise, refiners will begin making more of them, and less gasoline. So there'll be a balance, so sort of some form of equilibrium struck there. It may not come soon enough to, you know, please a lot of truckers, and it may not be enough to keep certain, you know, trucking outfits and airlines in business, but the market will adjust to some point. The larger question, you know, this notion of peak oil is really critical because if we are indeed in a peak, that is, if we can no longer raise production, get more barrels of oil out of the ground every day to meet demand, then you know, $120 oil is going to seem like a bargain. And, you know, people have been sort of predicting a peak in oil for, you know, really decades. And again, a peak isn't running out, just to clarify. What it means is that, you know, we're producing about 85 million barrels a day, and under normal circumstances, we could anticipate producing 86 the next year and maybe 87.5 the following year. And if you've actually hit a peak in production, you can't produce a peak, or you can't produce more. So the question has been, when does a peak occur? And as the caller points out, some fairly pessimistic folks would argue that we're in the middle of a peak, and this is what a peak looks like, and that's part of the reason that oil prices are going so high. Whereas, you know, optimists will argue that, well, we've still got, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 years. The tough thing about phenomena that are as complex and global as oil production, I mean, oil is being produced and distributed at thousands of places around the globe, and it's very difficult to get an accurate picture in real time as to how that's going, particularly since so many people's reserves, like in Saudi Arabia, that's sort of private information. They can tell us precisely what they want to tell us. We have to infer by indirect evidence how much oil they really have, or how much trouble they're having raising their production. But what we're beginning to suspect is that producers like Saudi Arabia are no longer able to raise their production as easily as they could. We know that Russia has already, you know, declared that it may be in peak production, that it's going to have trouble raising production. We know that Mexico is having some declines. I mean, you can look around the globe and see that, you know, production's having a hard time keeping up with demand. But again, it's probably going to be several years when we have some data and when we can draw some trend lines before we can say more definitively we hit a peak. This raises the precautionary principle. I mean, as in the debate with climate, we can wait until we're absolutely certain that climate change is happening before we, you know, take any action. But at that point, it may be too late. And I think the same holds for peak oil. You know, we can wait until 2015 or 2020 till we really know that we're in deep trouble, or we can begin to take steps now to reduce our need for oil so that the shock of a peak is much less painful. And again, because energy is so closely related to things like climate, And because oil is so problematic in political terms and environmental terms, it would behoove us to move off it anyway. Peak is just another sort of really good argument for doing that quickly. But the challenge with peak is that it may come up so quickly that we don't have the time for an orderly transition away from oil, and then instead we start adopting emergency and, I think, dangerous alternatives.
Bobby, thanks very much for the question. Very provocative. And on to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Very interesting program. I have a question, excuse me, comment and a question. Based the comment is sort of in reaction to what some of the other callers have said. As far as the subsidy of ethanol is concerned, just to play devil's advocate for a moment, we already subsidize oil to the tune of about $5 a gallon. It's been said that if you factor in this war, we wouldn't care a whit what's going on in the Middle East without oil. This war is costing us, depending on who you listen to, $600 billion to $1 trillion so far, and that adds up to about $10 a gallon. And and that's not even taking into account the blood of the soldiers who are dying, as well as the casualties, the lost human productivity, the lost human potential. That's just the monetary part. I would rather subsidize an industry at home rather than subsidize a military-industrial complex doing, you know, wars abroad myself, and literally subsidizing gasoline with the blood of our children. Now, as far as my question is concerned, Americans, as well as citizens in all the advanced countries of like Western Europe and some of the countries in the Far East, they've gotten used to being mobile. It's part and parcel of what people see as freedom. Now, as people's standards of living start to decline and their mobility is reduced, that's going to cause political unrest. I mean, serious political unrest, destabilized governments, violent destabilization of governments. What do you think is the solution for this problem?
Well, I mean, it's a really good point that, you know, we have to look not just at kind of popular targets today like ethanol, which are being subsidized, but look at the whole energy network and ask, you know, how much is all of this costing us? And it is a really good point that oil is heavily subsidized, both directly in terms of tax breaks to oil companies, but also in terms of the military expenditures to sort of keep the Middle East stable. So then you could say, well, given if we add up all the real cost of every energy technology that we have, then does, say, something like ethanol make sense? And you might be able to make the case for it, except that I think you have a climate issue, and you also have the food price issue. But I think the idea of lining up all these energy technologies and assessing their real costs would be a very useful exercise, because I think people would be really surprised at just what they're getting and what they're paying for, you know, what they're paying for themselves and what they're paying for in indirect means. The question about, you know, do we give up our mobile society and what does that mean politically? I think that we will, you know, reach a point where the mobility that we take for granted in this country and in other advanced societies is a luxury. And maybe we reach a point where the market simply reprices it so that it is a luxury, so that we take a car vacation once every 3 years or 5 years. Maybe that's how this will be portioned out. Maybe the rationing will be much more politically driven. But I think we're going to reach a point where that's the case. And yes, you know, if that disrupts economic development and hurts people economically in countries that are just now emerging from poverty, I can absolutely see, you know, political unrest and violence following. You know, people tend to get very angry, frightened and angry when they feel that, you know, newly won security and stability is being taken from them. So, I mean, that's sort of the bad news. My hope is that, you know, the energy crisis, climate concerns, and now the financial and sort of housing crisis might be enough to provoke people to rethink what it is they actually need and to reassess their sort of their participation in a consumer society. I mean, I hate to sound all socialist and radical and, you know, Mother Jones-ish here, but the truth is that we can talk about new technologies, we can talk about government policies, we can talk about all kinds of sort of top-down or top-down solutions or, you know, Silicon Valley solutions, but, you know, this economy is driven by consumer purchases, 70%.
We're going to have to leave it right there. I'm sorry, Paul, we've run out of time. Appreciate your spending the hour with us. You can read more about his thoughts in The Seven Myths of Energy Independence, which appears in the May-June 2008 issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Thanks to all of the callers. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network.